All right, welcome to episode 26 of the Bobbycast. In the big recliner next to me is Chris Jansen. Chris, how are you, bud?
I'm doing good, brother. Thank you very much. I love your intro music, by the way.
Yeah, I don't even know where this came from. Mike, do you?
It's a game show.
It just says game show music.
I thought you stole it from Wayne Newton. It sounds good.
No, it does sound...
Sounds Vegas-y.
Like, yeah. It's not unusual to be loved by anyone.
Dog-a-shay.
I was in Vegas this last weekend, and we ran into your boys, Low Cash.
You did?
Because they played the same stage the night before.
NFR.
Yeah, yeah. The National Finals Rodeo. And they were playing, I think, six of like eight nights, all in different places.
Oh yeah.
And so I saw Preston walking around because they were playing every night in Vegas.
Oh, they're like everywhere all the time, man. And they play NFR every year. And you're exactly right. They play like a 7-day residency in different places. It's wild. I don't know how they keep up with it.
Those guys. When Preston came, because we had Preston up, like four or five episodes ago.
Yeah.
Maybe more than that. Mm-hmm. I talked about you a bit. You guys are close.
He's one of my best friends.
That's what he said.
Love him.
He said, as far as like Nashville goes, like you guys have been friends for like close friends for a long time.
Real buddies.
Yeah.
We came up together.
And there's a difference in real buddies and work friends that you get along with and work well with.
Precisely.
And then just acquaintances.
And then acquainted people.
That are fine. Exactly. Then there are people you don't like too, but you know, whatever. But you're like real friends.
Yeah, we are real friends.
The weird thing about the Preston when he came over, because I like those guys a lot.
Me too.
And Preston and I had only ever spent time together either doing the radio show or we'd be on the road and play some, we played, I think, four shows together,
mm-hmm.
The Raging Idiots, and we got to hang out there, but we never got to hang out in like a real human setting. So we just sat at the house and talked for like 45 minutes after this here. And I was like, dang, like I used to like that dude. Now I really like that
dude. Yeah, he has a long story, dude. Like he's got a lot of wisdom.
His stories and their story, because we sat here and did the same thing.
They've been around.
And have been through it all.
Oh, yeah.
But you have, too. And Chris Jansen's here, and we're going to start with that in a second. Let me talk about Blue Apron for 1 second. Blue Apron comes to your house for less than $10 a meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. And Blue Apron knows that when you use great ingredients, you make great meals. And they mail it to your house. It's in a box. It's all the ingredients. You cook it. Don't even tell someone that you're using it if you don't want to, and you'll look like a master chef. This week, check out the menu and 3 free meals. All you have to do is go to blueapron.com/BobbyMeals. Bobby, M-E-A-L-S, Bobby Meals. You love how good it feels and tastes, and blueapron.com/BobbyMeals. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, Chris, we'll start with today, and we'll just kind of work our way around.
Sounds good.
Your song on the radio right now is Holding Her.
Here it is.
And I'm
holding
her. It's like. So first time I heard the song was on Buy Me a Boat, the record.
Yes.
And I thought, it's a good song.
Thank you.
It's a good, but I wasn't moved by it yet. Now, smash cut, 3 weeks later, maybe around that time I was watching it, something called New Faces in Nashville this last year.
Yes.
And you played this. When you get a new album, you kind of just pop through every track when you get it. You're like, okay, I like that one, I like that one. You really don't spend a lot of time with a lot of songs.
Yep, I don't, for sure.
And so you played Holding Her, and I was like, oh, my God, that is such a freaking good song.
Thank you, buddy.
And I was talking to your label head, who I really like, to John Esposito, and I was like, God, if that's not the next song you put on the radio, like, you shouldn't even put songs out on the radio. Like, just go ahead and send Chris back, because that song is so
much.
Good. And as I look today, Holding Her is now at 25 and still climbing. So talk about this song for a second.
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliments on it and the kind words. It is, my backstory, my wife and all my kids. And CRS, you mentioned the Country Radio Seminar show, the New Faces thing, where there was like five or six artists. The thing was, man, it was just kind of a no-brainer moment. And for me, it's always been a no-brainer moment because – obviously, I'm very married to the song, being the writer and singer of it. However, it's such a true life event for me, and I live it daily. And so the fact that it had the opportunity to come out, the fact that it did come out, and the fact that everyone has embraced it as they have, and by the way, thank you, is just an incredible blessing to me, man. And, you know, there's one thing to be said about songs climbing the charts, but when it's climbing the charts in a way that is a song that means so much to you personally, and I mean on a deeper level than just a song that you sing live at your shows and people stand up for, okay?
Okay, we'll talk about that for a second in case people don't know. Why does this song mean so much to you?
You know, it's the truest. Out of all the songs I've ever written, it's the truest. I saw my wife for the first time in Nashville in an underground pool hall, which is called Melrose Billiards, years ago. And she was working a job for a record label at the time, scoping out songs and songwriters. And I was down there hanging out with friends. And I just fell in love at first sight. I mean, I really did fall in love at first sight. And, you know, 3 years later, we got married, which was amazing. And it was just like God's timing, just perfect timing. And I walked into a house that was already a home with the kids in it, two kids, and that I started calling my bonus kids. It's like, I hate the word stepkids. And then we had two kids together, and really life just became just unbelievable. I mean, my life really changed for the better. We've been married 7 years, going on eight, and it's just been one of the most incredible blessings ever, aside from anything with business or music or anything for that matter. And when I wrote this song, James Otto and I were on his back porch, and over in Green Hills in Nashville, and we had just had Georgia, our youngest daughter, together, and our third child. And he said, "Man, what do you want to write today?" And I said, "Dude, I just want to write about my family." And it just came out. We wrote it in about 20-30 minutes. And you know, that song is the oldest song on the Buy Me a Boat record, which is what a lot of people don't know. It's the oldest one on there. I wrote it years before Buy Me a Boat or anything else on the whole album. And you know, it finally got to breathe and live on this album. And now that it's living on the radio, it's a huge deal for me. And I've been playing it around for so many years that now when people hear it and then they hear it on the radio, it's like they're putting two and two together, going, "Oh my God!" You know, it's been a lot of people's favorite song for a lot of years on the, you know, from touring and things of that nature. And since Buy Me a Boat was such a big breakthrough, it allowed my audiences to get much bigger, thankfully. And now when they hear Holding Hair, it's a beautiful thing.
The cool thing about it is too, it's not a traditional radio song, and right. The fact that it is still climbing the charts does speak volumes, because one, it's a ballad.
Yes.
Two, it's a very country ballad with talking in it.
Yes, and steel guitar.
And so there are all these elements that right now aren't mixed together, currently moving up the chart.
Right. Well, thank you very much. And thanks for making light of that too, because I am such a fan of songs, man, like Sunday Morning Coming Down, or I mean, you could think of a million songs that have any kind of Conway song. So many of my favorite, what you would call now traditional country music, has some spoken word in it. Even some George Strait records out of the last 10 years, you know, I mean, they have some spoken word in it. And Holding Her, I didn't really mean to go for that. I wasn't like shooting for anything. It just happened that way. And when it feels right to me in my heart, man, that's just how I fall. That's how I gauge everything. That's how I just do anything in my whole life. When I get up to put my boots on in the morning, if it feels right, I'll put on that pair. If it feels wrong, I put on another pair.
But you're getting too big. Time to get a new shoe size, buddy, if they ain't feeling right.
I got to get some sneakers, man. But you know, that's how Holding Her came together. And this is a beautiful thing, dude. I'm so grateful for it. And for people to take a chance on it at radio and to be playing it like they are. I mean, like you said, for it to still be moving up the chart and to be such a different kind of song is it's a pretty incredible blessing.
So you have actually two songs on the radio right now. One that you sing on and yes. One that you wrote on,
yes.
Which is this one. McGraw, How I'll Always Be. Dogs and guitars playing. Wondering churches, back road walks, and front porch swinging. Sunset skies, bonfire nights. I love the simple things. That's how I'll always be. That's a good one. So,
thanks, buddy.
When did you write that? Was it after the record came out? Is this one that you were writing for Tim, or writing to Pitch, or for yourself? Or what was the process with this song?
First of all, I love these questions, and I didn't thank you for having me yet this evening. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Mike, he's the first one to ever bring a gift.
Yeah.
Well, like, we've had...
Whoa, you can thank my wife. You can thank my wife. She had the initial idea, and I said, that's a great idea. Because I don't know what to... you know,
There's nothing to get me.
You're a man of many tastes, very peculiar taste, just as I am. And, you know, you gotta be touchy-feely with what you get. So I'm glad you liked it. However, thank you for having me, and thank you for these questions, because I rarely get to talk about songs, and I rarely get to give the backstory on them. And to answer your question about That's How I'll Always Be, first of all, when you played that, I just love that song. Even if I hadn't written it, I'm so proud of it.
So you're sitting in a room.
I got to tell you this story, man. This is an amazing thing. My friend Jeremy Stover called me. He said, "Hey, CJ, let's write a song." So, okay, fine. So I went over to write with him. When I get to a studio in Berry Hill, which is over on the other side of Nashville, a friend of ours texted us both at the same time, named Jamie Polly. He said, "Hey, man," or "Hey, guys," you know, can I come over and are either of you available to write? And we said, "Hey, we're actually together. I don't know how you knew that," but he didn't. "Why don't you come join us?" He got there. He's kind of having a rough day, man. He got there and he started explaining what was going on. His mom had pretty terminally ill cancer. And it just hit everybody pretty hard, to be frankly honest with you. And so we just tried to lighten the mood by doing something. And writing songs is what we do best. So I knew McGraw was pretty much done recording at that point. And thankfully, I've been able to get to know Tim a little bit and hear some inside things. So I thought, well, you know, we maybe missed the record this time, but let's just write something. I said, "Guys, I'd like to write another side of my story, the other side of holding her, like my backstory as a man, you know, and tell a little bit of that. Let's write it in the vein of McGraw. And man, maybe for the next record, he might like it, you know?" And so the song really came together and it meant a lot to all three of us, but it really meant a lot to me personally because all the words in it are my story. It's a very true to life song for me, every single little bit of it. And the most important part is I sent it to Byron Gallimore, like, 3 days after we wrote it. We did a little work tape demo of it. He's, "Oh my gosh, I love this."
Who's that? Byron Gallimore.
Yeah, sorry. So Byron Gallimore produces Tim McGraw. He produced part of the Buy Me a Boat record. He's a great friend of mine and great friend of ours and just love Byron. And he and his wife, they both work with Tim. His wife finds songs for Tim every now and again, and Byron produces the songs. You know, I sent it to Byron to see what he thought, and he was like, "Oh my God." So he sent it to Tim, and immediately I get put on this email chain. It's Tim loves it. He's going to cut it.
Wow.
Just like, I mean,
so
just
how
like that.
Quick, how many days, hours, I don't know
did
how quick we're talking here, from the minute you sent the work tape or the demo to him to the fact that you're on the email going, "Hey, I love this song."
Within the first 15 minutes.
It was that quick?
I swear to God, man. I got it from Jeremy. I was like, "Hurry, get it to me, hurry, get it to me, hurry, get it to me." You know, I'm like a hurry up and wait kind of guy. I just can't stand it, okay? I just have to get going. And I said, "Can you please send it to me? Please send it to me." "Yeah, I'm just getting the vocal." I said, "Forget the vocal. Just send me the track." So I sent it to Byron. "Oh my God, Chris, I just love this," is what Byron said. And that's how he talks. He got back and sent it to Tim. Within 15 minutes, I was leaving FedEx in Cool Springs down in Franklin. And I mean, it just happened. And I mean, you never know. I mean, I've had a million artists say, "Oh, we're going to cut it. Oh my God, we love it." And then never cut it or never even look at it. You know, dude, Tim is a man of his word and he's very good about keeping it too. And he recorded the song. He said, and you know, one thing that I'll never forget Tim McGraw telling me was, "Thank you for writing me the song I always wanted to record." It was a really amazing moment for me. And I didn't know that I was being a part of the song that he always wanted to record. I just knew that he likes, you know, he likes Don Williams type things. He likes Guy Clark. He likes, you know, old Stray Dogs and guitars play. And he likes Tom T. Hall, you know, those sorts of things. And it was just a really gratifying moment for me. Now, fast forward, the song's on the radio is doing good and looking like it may be, you know.
That's fantastic. It's not doing good. It's doing great.
Thank you.
With the potential to really
to be a number one record, yeah, hopefully. You know, either way, it's already a hit. It's already a big top 10. But here's the thing. The most important part of the story and the journey is, you know, rewind up. I told you about Jamie and his mom. Jamie's mom just passed away a little while back here, right about the time How Will Always He was coming out and was about to hit the top 20. And so this is a really trying time for his family. I know he's, you know, been going through a little bit personally. He's a great guy. And, you know, Jamie at this point, being the third co-writer, man, at this point, like, Jeremy's had a ton of number ones. He just wrote "I Love Somebody" for our boys Low Cash. Like, he's on fire. He produces Justin Moore. I mean, he's like all over the board. And and thankfully, you know, since Boat, man, things have really been seeming to go my way. And Jamie has had some good cuts to his name, but this is his biggest one yet. And with the chain of events that everything's happened in his life, that just really makes me smile, because I'm proud that he got a hold of us. I'm proud that he is a third songwriter on this song, and that the story you know, it, if we're fortunate enough to have a number one with a man, it's going to be an awesome, very emotional party.
I saw, speaking of McGraw, you're going to be playing with McGraw, I think, at the end of this week or early next week.
Yeah, Saturday night we're playing in Vegas.
Okay, so I just came back from Vegas, and I saw everywhere Tim McGraw and Chris Jansen, you know.
Sweet.
And it was a picture of you.
Really?
Two, and I was like, that's cool, you know, because you're everywhere. Like, it's obviously a Tim poster, but
awesome.
Very prominent Chris Jansen on the poster, which doesn't always happen.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
There was another one that was like Toby Keith in a tiny letters that goes, with Bing and Rich. And I was like, wait, they're bigger than they should have just with Bing and Rich. But it was really Tim McGraw with Chris Jansen, with, you know, you had your picture with your strap over. And so I'm getting in the elevator. I was talking about this on the air this morning. Because they had us in a really fancy part of MGM. Because when we played MGM, the Raging Idiots did, and they put you in a really nice hotel, put us in a suite. You're in the fancy place.
The mansion.
And I got into this elevator, and it's all mirrored out and like chandelier on top. And I swear, I'm not exaggerating. I swear to you, as I'm in, because I Snapchatted it, as I'm in the elevator to this fancy hotel, I hear, you know, when I'm there's playing as I'm going down. I'm
you're
like,
kidding.
No.
That's awesome.
But, and they weren't like playing just country. It was all different music.
Right.
And they were playing Holdin' Her as I was going down the elevator.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
All my worlds are colliding
right
now.
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool, man. It was cool. Let's talk about how you got here for a second.
Yeah,
so,
brother.
You born and raised in Missouri?
I was born and raised in Missouri, just above Arkansas, where you're from, yeah.
So as a kid, you were what kind of kid?
I was a very shy kid at times. Boy, we've never talked about this. This is going to be good. I was a very shy kid at times. You know, I always was a musician. Always a musician.
What do you mean? How are you a musician at 7 or 8? What were you playing?
Man, I started when I was 8 years old. I got my first Stratocaster guitar and immediately started playing the blues. I started playing. My first song I ever learned was Keep Your Hands to Yourself, Georgia Satellites. And I loved the blues, man. I loved the blues. I loved rock and roll. I loved country music. My first album I ever got was Garth Brooks, the one where he tied his belt sideways with a double-sided shirt. And my second one was Randy Travis, man. And I remember my dad used to sing Digging Up Bones around the house all the time and stuff. And I've always been a musician, and I've always been a very meek and mild kind of guy.
Why were you a musician? Were your parents musicians at all? Anybody
no.
in your family that kind of made you say, hey, you should pick up a guitar?
So my parents are not musicians. My dad took a swing at drumming there for a while when I was like a early teen. But he would tell you like it was just a for fun, you know, garage band, drink some beer kind of thing. But, you know, traditionally, like my granddad played a little guitar, but not much. And his father before him was a Pentecostal a tent revival evangelist. And he played fiddle and that kind of thing. So I guess music probably runs in my veins at some point. Very kind of Appalachian, you know, kind of country bluegrass kind of stuff.
But there wasn't anyone in your life that said, hey, here's a piano or a guitar, you should start playing.
No, not at all. It was me. It was totally me. I wanted to be...
Who did you see, though, at 8 that made you want to pick up a guitar? Because something had... You had to see something with your eyeballs.
Guns N' Roses.
So that's what it was.
Oh, my God. I was like, I want to be Duff McKagan, and I want to be that
Of all
bad.
Them, you picked Duff. Now, later on, and we'll get to Guns N' Roses in a minute, but later on... I mean, but yeah, early, so it wasn't Slash, it wasn't Axl.
No, it was Duff McKagan. I thought, dude, that dude with the long blonde hair was like just cool looking. I mean, and he is cool looking. It's like, I want to be that. I want to be that right there. And I always thought David Lee Murphy was the bomb. Like, I mean, where I come from, I mean, first of all, he is, and everybody thinks so. Second of all, where I come from in the Midwest, you know, we grew up right across the Mississippi River from each other. Literally, I bought my first car with lawn mowing money out of his hometown, 2 blocks away from the street he grew up on. Small world. I was a huge David Lee Murphy fan as far as country music goes. And he was, you know, he's still like, he's kind of a rock and roll tight jeans wearing kind of guy. And so those two things made me really want to play, man. And funny you should ask, I never got to tell anybody that.
So you start playing guitar at 8 years old.
Yep.
When do you start playing where people start watching you?
Pretty immediately. When I started playing, you know, that was right at the brink of about to go into middle school. So, you know, I was a skateboarder, and I was also in 4-H, and I was riding horses. I did a lot of different things as a kid. I dabbled a lot of stuff, but I loved to skateboard. The skateboarding community, as most know, will lead you into like different kinds of communities. It'll lead you like into the hippie crowd and the cool crowd and, you know, the misled youth crowd who listens to punk rock all the time. And I got way into that kind of stuff. And I started meeting buddies who thought like me, who thought outside the box, who grew up in a small town and wanted to get out of it and found outlets in music. And so we all just started skating together, and we built like a local skate park in Phelps Park in town. And man, we started getting our instruments from Shivel Vines Music, which was a town 35 miles away, and Cape Girardeau is a little music store there. And dude, we just got the cheapest of the cheap guitars and started playing. And me and my buddy Kurt Brewer and Anthony Laurentius and all these kids, man, we just got together from all different grades, middle school and high school, and started playing music. And we play anything anybody wanted to hear.
What were you in that band?
I was the drummer.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you picked up a guitar, then you were the drummer in the band.
Yeah, I was like the drummer one week, and then like if we needed a bass player, I'd be like bass player. I mean, it's whatever. I mean, we all kind of alternated. However, you know, my first instrument is drums. I learned that very first, and then guitar came like the week after. I forgot to tell you that, but I'm a drummer first, and I'm still a drummer. I play drums every night actively in my live concerts, and I am the kind of person that I'm going to try it really quick. And if I can't get it really quick, I'm done. I'm just going to move on to something else. I'm still that way.
Yeah, your attention span is very small. Why? Both of us are.
We're very
we need it. We got to figure it. Okay.
Don't we have the same birthday?
We do.
Yeah. So, I mean, it says
a lot.
We have
a lot of similarities. Yeah. We have addictive personalities, both of
exactly.
us, too.
Exactly. I'm back on the do, by the way. no, man. So, like, I wanted to play the drums, right? Let me just tell you. So, I learned to play them. I learned to play them in school. And I was like, okay, cool. Then I got the Stratocaster guitar. I learned to play Georgia Satellites. I was like, I got that. So I got a bass guitar. I'm like, well, that's pretty easy. Same thing. And then I got on piano, and I love Jerry Lee Lewis. I'm like, and I figured that out. Okay, I taught myself. And, dude, I just started hop skipping around, and then you meet the right kids. And it was usually kids who were, like, unpopular, kids who nobody wanted to hang out with, kids with, like, green hair and weird earrings. And, I mean, I grew up in a pretty, like, frankly, a pretty redneck, you know, white trash, blue collar town, man. Like, you just, if you're not a farmer, you're not cool, you know, that kind of thing. Like, everybody hangs out at the MFA and City Tavern downtown, and that's just the way it is. And if you don't play football, you're a punk and that kind of deal. And I was definitely kind of right in the middle.
So you're playing music. Did you graduate high school?
I did. I graduated with honors, man. I graduated, I was actually offered to graduate my junior year.
I know you got a scholarship. I'm going to lead into the scholarship, but
with,
go ahead.
With college credits and stuff, but I chose to stay in school because my senior year, they offered a work program where I could actually make some little bit of cash and go to work and try something that I thought maybe I would want to do for a living. Because when you're a kid, you don't think, you honestly, where I come from, you don't really think that, oh my God, I can be a music singing star or anything for that matter. I can't even have a job doing this, you know?
You know why? And we come from a similar background. You don't think, it's not because people tell us we can't, but no one tells us we can because nobody else does around
because
us.
Because you're precisely right. It's like nobody tells you you can't, but no one tells you you can because no one else is doing it. And we come from, and you know what? It's okay because now as an adult, I come to appreciate it. And actually, you know, some things you kind of miss sometimes is weird. But I grew up in such a inside the box kind of mindset. I'm sort of cursed with it. I'm still that way a little bit. It's things you never grow out of, but I grew up so much around that it was just kind of unreachable, you know?
You know, when you say that, it resonates with me because I speak at times and I'll speak at graduations or I'll speak to youth and I'll say that a lot because I'll talk to kids who grew up like I did.
Yeah.
And I'll say, you know, these big dreams, no one tells you you really can't do them because they don't seem real. No one tells you you can't grow 10 feet tall.
Right.
Because everybody knows you're not going to do it anyway.
Right.
But no one, so I would say, listen, this is what I've done. No one told me I couldn't, but really no one told me I can. And so I'll talk to the parents, say, tell them they can. You know, but they can. I mean, look at you. Look at you. You're a prime example of nobody telling you you can, but you just went and did.
Yeah. I know one other kid who did it in my hometown, man. It was the one kid that I consistently stayed in bands with. It was also the one kid that I consistently stayed in bands and butted heads with because we were both A personalities, which now we even still keep in touch via email and phone. Actually, two of my friends, I can't forget the other one. One stayed in the States and went on having a great career playing drums for the Avett Brothers and Bob Dylan and lots of people.
Wow.
Okay, his name's Jacob Edwards. His dad was our choir teacher. We had choir teacher and a band teacher in high school. My music teacher, band teacher, flunked me and did not like me at all. And treated me very badly as a kid very badly. Why do you think that was? For many years. I don't mean this to sound cocky whatsoever, but I was a natural at music, and people like him aren't. They are theoretical. They have to read. They
like
to read.
I don't think it's cocky for you to say you're a natural at music. You're a freaking number one songwriter.
But you know what I mean? But I don't mean it pretentious.
It's not,
but
nothing about you is pretentious.
Well,
just
thank you.
From the
heart. But for people who, you know, don't know me, I like to let them know. I don't mean that pretentious. But Mr. Fisher was not nice to me. He was just not. He just wasn't nice to me. He
probably felt threatened.
He did. And that's a sad thing in school, man. A lot of teachers, you know, they probably got picked on at one point. They're really, you know, he's a very smart guy. However, I may be a little bit smarter. I don't know. But the thing is I flunked that, but I got an A in chorus, which I didn't want to take. And it was Mr. Edwards. His son, Jacob, is the one I was in the band with. Man, he was a free spirit. He was just about just do what you want to do. And we're just going to praise your art. No matter how bad or good it is, it doesn't matter. And believe me, we're pretty bad, okay? And Jacob is one of the kids who came out of school and did something with his life as far as music and became very successful, and I think lives in East Nashville now. And another one of my friends who grew up two towns away, and he grew up in an even smaller, like very Catholic community where you were very frowned upon if you did any kind of music or rock and roll or anything of that nature, Ian Fisher. And now he's a very critically acclaimed singer-songwriter in Europe and lives in Germany and is awesome. That's what he does. He travels around Europe and plays shows and just a pretty amazing thing, man. I feel very blessed to have the opportunities that I've had. And when you mention number one songwriter and singer and these things, it still doesn't register for me because, again, and you know this, coming from where we come from, your great successes with your career as well, it's just sort of unfathomable. And even now in my hometown, I only have about five friends who even recognize what I do for a living or they just don't even, you know what I mean? It just doesn't, it's just it's a two-way road and it's very disconnected.
So you're in the town.
Yeah.
Now you had an interest in animals like veterinary.
I did. Now I got the interest from animals and veterinarian because I told you earlier I rode a lot of horses as a kid. I did horse showing a whole bunch, actually a lot in Middle Tennessee, which is a whole other avenue to talk about. But long story short, when you get older and you get about 17 and you know, you're a pretty poor kid growing up, you got to have a job. I've had jobs since I was a young man. My dad said, I don't ever want to have to make you work. You know, you work when you get older, but I always had a job because I never like anybody telling me what I could do with my money. And I don't like asking for money. I'd rather make it myself, whether if it's $2, I got $2 and I didn't ask for it. Veterinarian work came pretty easy. There was a guy that played softball with my dad on the little softball leagues there. And Doc Freeman, and he always said, man, if you ever want to make some extra bank, why don't you just come over and work for me, you know, and just do whatever.
He's a vet.
He's a veteran. The only, like,
the town vet.
The town main, yeah. The main
yeah.
guy.
The
right?
vet.
Yeah, yeah, the guy.
There's always the whatever where we come from.
Yeah, exactly.
There's one person that does everything.
Yeah.
Because we can't handle two.
Yeah.
We couldn't have two gas stations.
Right? If we're going to have two, man, there's going to be a major fight, okay? It's like, you know what I'm saying? They're both going to run for mayor, too. Just go figure. Anyway, so Doc Freeman offered that, and so in my school too, even though small town, they had a vocational program because again, so many kids grew up in the agricultural business and that kind of thing. And traditionally you either go to the military or you become a farmer. It's pretty much it. Or you work at Walmart. It's one of three things. And my senior year, I'd already gotten all my credits out of the way. So I thought, cool, I'm going to take a vocational class and I'm going to take him up on it. So I went to work at a vet clinic and I darn near almost became a veterinarian. Like I was pretty serious about it. And the fact that like, I was pulling scholarships to almost go to do it. And
what kept you from it?
I never had it in my heart. Man, I was just doing it to make some money. And I knew that it would probably pay good at some point. You know, if you become a doctor or a veterinarian, obviously it pays okay. Dude, I played music. I've always played music, no matter what. I mean, on the weekends, I was playing on hay wagons in on 80 acres down in on the East End and for, you know, just a bunch of beer drinking Hank Jr. songs and Skinner covers and those kind of things. And I just had music in my heart. I'd never written a song at that point, but I loved playing and whatever band I was in at the time. So when it got right down to it, about a week before I was going to go off to college, I decided, well, I'm not going to do that. So I'm just going to go to the closest place that has music. And I wanted to get away from, you know, you always want to get away from where you come from. And then when you get out, you want to have some of that back. Which is interesting because I love I love small town lifestyles. My wife's from a small town. I love it. But Nashville was the closest. So I decided on a Thursday and packed up on Thursday afternoon and I moved. Never came back.
So you moved to Nashville. You're how old?
I just turned 19.
So you move here at 19, and where do you move?
I move in a 2-door Monte Carlo that you can, that folks can see. You know, that we talked about that country radio seminar show that I did. We did the video for it, and I put the green Monte Carlo in my video. Did a like kind of a lifestyle documentary.
You lived in a car.
I lived in the back seat of a car with the back seats would fold down. You know, and those cars. They don't make cars like that anymore. It's a really cool thing.
Yeah, because it's not safe. A lot of people, I'm glad they don't make... Listen, they made sense back then because there was more room. We used to stand in the seat.
There
weren't seat belts.
Bro, like, I have ridden on so many consoles of 86 Oldsmobiles with my head sticking out the old school sunroof. You know what I'm talking about?
Or, dude, we'd ride in the back of the truck. Like, you can't... All that's gone, though.
You ever lay to get warm in the back window of, like, a
yes.
Cutlass?
Yes, and on the like the reverse console,
you 100%.
Lay in it because that's where the heat comes at when the window comes down.
Duh.
So you lay in that spot. Yeah, you ever travel like 9 hours on a camper shell on the back of a truck because with blankets?
Yeah.
That was a road trip. You get in the truck and then like five of us get in the camper shell in the back of the truck with blankets
with a grandpa who's like kind of mean and only makes you eat ham sandwiches and will not pull over at Cracker Barrel. I mean, I'm saying that in a very nice way, by the way.
So you moved to Nashville. You're living in your car.
I'm living in a 2-door Monte Carlo.
How do you find a place to park? I mean, like, where do you park to live?
Okay, here's a good one for you. So I pull downtown and I pull what's now Honky Tonk Central on Lower Broadway in Nashville. It used to be Shaughnessy is an Irish pub, which was before my time here. I pulled into the parking lot back there. This is still when Lower Broadway is kind of like undeveloped. It's, you know, it's still kind of dangerous at night, that kind of thing. And
so those are listening. Lower Broadway is the main like tourist place in Nashville where
all
the bars are, where people come and they go to see all the music.
Yeah. And where a lot of people go, frankly, to try and quote, make it.
Right.
You know? And so it's just the bright lights and big city kind of thing. So I pulled there. I got a boot on my car the first night because I had never paid a meter. I have never paid a machine to get a ticket. Who would know? Coming from who knows?
I wrote about that in my book that I was like, when I moved to Little Rock and you had to pay for parking, I was blown away.
Blown away.
You had to pay to put your car. To me,
I'm still shocked.
It was a shock that I had to pay to put my car somewhere.
Oh, believe me, I know. I got a boot the first night. So I'm like, wow, this is awesome. So, but anyway, dude, I'm sleeping in the fold down. So half in the trunk, half in the car kind of thing. And, I literally moved here, quintessential story, with a physical backpack full of CDs, homemade, you know, just basically what you would call now garage band demos, that were really made in a garage on a 2-track dub recorder and, transferred over to CD with a sticky on top, you know? And so I came there and I was just basically busking up down Lower Broadway with a guitar case, totally Abercrombie'd out, Birkenstocks, the whole deal, and asking for gigs. And I'll never forget, I walked into Tootsie's at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and the bartender was like, I was like, oh, I'm here for a gig. I thought they were going to hand them out, like I could go to my hometown somewhere and just find a gig at a local pub or restaurant, you know, which you could do pretty easy. And I'll never forget this bartender named Susan. I'll never forget it. She looked me right in the eyes, laughed in my face, and goes, "You need to get the hell out of here. You're never going to make it here, ever. Never going to make it. Just get out of here."
Because of how you looked?
I think because of how I looked. I was so young. I mean, and believe me, at 19, I looked like I was 12. So it was like you put two and two together. It was just a weird thing. So I left, and I'm going up down the street, and I'm asking to go on stage. Nobody let me on stage.
Did you ever play on the street?
No. I just never wanted to go there, man. I never wanted to go there. I just figured this, if I'm not good enough to get into the bar, if I can't get in there to sing, which at that point to me was like, holy cow, I'm making it.
You're singing in Nashville.
I mean,
people are in Nashville watching you.
I'm famous. Like, it's happening.
Right.
Like, that's the feeling you get, right? So I go back that night and I beg a doorman to get me on stage. He puts me on stage.
Where? Back at Tootsie's?
At Tootsie's.
Okay.
The guy was so nice. It was like midnight. Puts me on stage. And do you want to hear something crazy? If I moved here CRS week.
So CRS is when all country radio comes to town and the artists are in town and they're every labels. I mean, it's a really busy radio-y week.
Yeah. So anyway, long story short, he puts me on stage. I played Folsom Prison, Johnny Cash, and I started the song out. And of course, the band, I was wondering why they were looking at me and rolling their eyes going, oh my God, because they've already played it 20 times that day, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's about midnight. There's 2 hours left. I play the song. Crowd goes wild. The owners are in the bar. Dude leans over the counter and goes, can you finish 2 more hours? I said,
that night.
Right then.
Yeah.
I said, yes, I can. So he looks at the other dude. I swear to God. Looks at the other dude who was singing. I just let me up on stage. He goes, you're fired. Go ahead. And I was like, okay. So I played 2 more hours worth of just anything I could think of. Hank Williams.
So you just call him out to the band, tell him what key.
I mean, literally, I would just start songs and they would just do it, you know. And so that was my intro to Nashville. And I got done about 2:30 in the morning. The next morning I had a gig. They asked me right after I got done. They said, can you be here in the morning to play? You want a gig? I said, yeah. 10 o'clock in the morning. I said, 10 o'clock? Who plays at 10 o'clock in the morning? I mean, what are you talking about?
Apparently you do.
Well, they're like, well, that's what time the honky-tonks open down here. And if you want a gig, yes or no? I said, absolutely. So I came in. I played acoustic and then got done with that one. It was a four-hour show. I got done with that one. Same thing. Dude was like, hey, man, we had a 2 o'clock actually cancel. You want to play the 2 to 6? Go put a band together. So I go on. Now, by the way, my car is still booted sitting in the parking lot. Okay? Never moved. I never really left. Okay? And plus, I don't know what to do with a boot, and plus, I'm trying to get a gig, and just trying to make it. Go put a band together. I had like 15 minutes. So I just start gathering people off the street, just people walking down with amps and guitars.
Like asking, hey, what do you play?
No, I swear to God. Yeah. There's so many musicians down there anyway, still are.
Right.
I mean, you go down there right now in Nashville, there'll be 50 guys walking into different bars and coming out of bars with pedal carts full of nice instruments and things, okay, drums or whatever. So I put a little band together, and I played the 2 to 6. Same thing for the 6 to 10. They go, why don't you go to the back room with Tootsie's and play the 6 to 10? Okay, fine. Now, keep in mind, I started at 10 o'clock that morning. So then I played the 6 to 10, and then I got the 10 to 2 that night. So I played 16 hours in one day and never left the bar, and I did that continuously for 364 more days until I got discovered for the first time.
So you played a whole year.
Yeah, I did.
16 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now, when did you finally get a roof, though?
Okay, so I got a roof. I was crashing in the car, man, for a pretty good little bit there.
What's a little bit?
3-4 weeks.
So and, you know, almost a solid month living in your car.
Yeah, but, you know, you meet people, too. And, you know, I'm talking about from barbacks, you know, just some nice dude slinging cases of beer or doorman or just whoever, Tyler Farr. The guy who owned the bar's son, you know, who was a college kid at the time, you know, and you know, you gotta have showers and stuff, of course. So, I mean, you crash a couch 2-3 times a week, maybe here and there, but most of the time, I mean, I'm very much living out of the car. And then about a month into it, I was able to, you know, get my own apartment, which I shared with, a doorman. Actually, the guy who first put me up on stage, Tyler Farr, was also crashing couches and doing that kind of thing and kind of jumping from apartment to apartment. So he would sleep at our place a lot and, you know, pay a little rent every now and again, that kind of thing. And you just make it. And my first place was over in Antioch.
Did you ever – I'm wondering if it's you. Did you ever sleep on the lower level on the floor of Eric Pasley's wife's house?
No.
Was it not Jansen? Who was it that used to stay in Pasley?
Natalie?
Yeah, it was Natalie. But it wasn't Jansen?
Stovall, not this guy.
Maybe it was Stovall. Maybe it was one of the Stovall. Man, because there are a bunch of you guys that you just used to migrate around.
Oh, dude. I lived in Antioch over off of Lebanon Road. And right on the back of the railroad tracks. Pretty shady. Pretty shady. Pretty shady setup, not going to lie.
You know what shady means, though? Cheap.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. But I was like, there's a lot of money and, you know, that kind of thing. But hey, you know, the deal is, man, you just do what you can. And before I moved to Nashville, I saved every penny I could to mowing lawns, selling snow cones. I had a little snow cone business going on. I was a pretty entrepreneurial guy. And, you know, one thing after the other and gigs and that kind of thing. And I'm not talking like big money. I'm talking like maybe $25 a show kind of deal or, you know, $20 a night on snow cones. But I moved here with a little bit of cash in my pocket. And that sort of thing, and just made it from nothing. You started from the bottom.
We're going to play a spot here for one of our sponsors with Chris Jansen right now.
Looking for the perfect gift this season?
Want to avoid the malls and lines this year? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how, for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code BONES in the search bar. That's 77% off. For less than $50, you get two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, a 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional kielbasa sausages free. All of this for less than $50. If you're looking for convenient and quick shopping for those on your list, go to omahasteaks.com. Enter the code BONES in the search bar, add the family gift pack to your cart, and get a 77% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
All right, we are back. All right, so you played at Tootsie's for how long?
A year.
So a solid year at Tootsie's. When you say being you were discovered, who saw you and what did they discover you for?
So I would say about 3/4 of the way through the year. First of all, I was packing it out like they say nobody else ever has. The fire marshal shut us down all through the year, all the time when I would play, that kind of thing, and it's, you know, certain times more than others. But music business is what I mean. By being discovered, people from the industry, you know, A&R executives, label presidents, publishers, booking agents, those kind of things. My first real break came from a movie director named Jonathan Demme, who, did Heart of Gold for Neil Young and Stop Making Sense. I think he just did the Timberlake thing too. But anyway, he came in and was spot checking the Ryman and Tootsie's and just kind of downtown, just Nashville as a total vibe for the Heart of Gold documentary on Neil Young, and saw me playing and was like, okay, I think you might be great for this documentary, you know, and wanted to cast me in it. And that was kind of my intro to, a little bit of success and maybe perhaps my first paycheck, which ended up being my first paycheck. Neil Young caught his attention and they put me in the documentary, a small part, but a part nonetheless. And after that, that really, you know, really sparked a lot of, talk. Because I was just some kid in Lower Broadway, and not to
how
mention,
old at the time,
19, my first year, yeah, and not to mention then, you know, then everybody started flooding in from the industry. It wasn't just fans and things like that; they were coming amongst the fans, and I'm talking about just anybody who's anybody, man. And
so you're being scouted by the whole town.
Yeah, I didn't know it though.
Right,
I had no clue. I would have no problem sending a tip jar around to whoever it might have been at the time.
So you say you didn't get a paycheck. You were getting paid in tips.
Yeah, tips only. Only tips.
And so you'd play, if someone gave you a 20, that was a big one?
Huge.
You play whatever they want.
I play anything for any. I play something for a dollar.
Somebody gives you a 20, though. Do they jump the line?
It's a big deal.
Everybody give you 100?
Dude, people used to flood my we made like $7,500 bucks one night.
One night?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so how do you split that up? If you're the main guy,
yeah,
and you're really the main guy, they're not coming to watch the bass play, although he is doing his work.
I'm the dude, right?
Yes.
Okay, or whoever, for that matter, is the dude or the chick, okay? When it's Lower Broadway style, bro, it's mano a mano. It is every man is equal, no matter what. That's just how they look at it down there, and it's just the way it is. So when you're tip jarring it, you just split it. You know, if there's four people there.
So you
stage,
split it four ways.
Split it four ways.
So you made $7,500 in a night. Was there a super corporate event or something that happened that night? Like,
no. Just,
anything special about who it was?
No, I just used to hustle, man. I used to hustle. I still hustle. I am a hustler. Like, I know that sounds so ghetto, but I am a hustler, dude. I don't come from anything. I come from parents who worked really hard and did okay for themselves, but. In the grand scheme of things, man, I just never forget being told one time, son, I don't have it to give to you. And I said, from that moment on, I will never live like this. I won't. And that's not meaning, I'm not meaning dirt floors and poor by any means. I'm just saying not extra to go around. And, I just said right then, I'm just not going to live this way. I'm going to hustle and do whatever I have to do to make money. And when you're playing out of a tip jar, you damn sure have to hustle. You have to learn to make it, because believe me, if you have five people in there from 10 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, you know how many people that is? Five people. And then, by the way, you got to give a tip share to bartenders, tip share to doorman, and you're not making much money. So you have to be good, number one. You have to know your repertoire, number two. And you have to be able to sing anything, and I mean anything. Because if you don't, they'll go right next door to the next bar and find some other guy who is.
As you're doing this and you're playing Tootsies for a year, and listen, I waited tables for a year, so I know, and it's definitely not the same, but there's a culture.
Yeah, this is a, there's basically a
nighttime,
the same.
There's a nighttime culture.
Absolutely.
And it's a different lifestyle.
Yes.
Now, were you ever caught up in that lifestyle with any of the alcohol, the drug abuse? Because it's crazy. I had to stay away from it because I knew what I would do. I'd go right into it, and I would kill myself.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking. I never had a drink until I was 22, and I've never done a drug in my life, ever. Not ever once. Never even smoked the pot.
The pot. That's funny. We have so much in common, you know.
Swear to God.
So, okay.
And yeah. I haven't drank in 8 years. I'm 30 now.
You start 22. So did you just drink for a minute?
I did. And
did
I
you
buddy,
drink hard for
and
a minute,
buddy,
though?
I went hard.
Because that's how I see you doing. Like, I don't see you doing anything halfway.
Oh, no. The last date we had, by the way, my wife and I still date. We're going to date tonight. Here's the thing. Before we're married, the last date we had, the official one, I'm like 16 long necks in. I mean, like, I go hard when I drink, man. It's like, if you're going to drink, dude, get drunk. If not, just what is the point?
Okay, so I've never had a drink, and it feels like it tastes, it smells like just piss.
Oh, God, I just hate
like,
it.
Like, why would I drink if I didn't just want to get hammered?
Honestly.
Why would I drink?
Honestly, dude, I never had a drink until I was 22. Can you believe that? 22. And when I did, I was like, dude, I'm getting it so messed up.
So why'd
up
you
right
stop?
Now. I stopped because I met the love of my life that I wanted to be completely committed to, and she had kids.
Did you do as I do and just go, okay, I have to stop right now, full, boom, done.
I'm done. Haven't had a drink since.
Crazy.
I'm 30 years old.
Crazy.
Done. I take that back. I don't want to lie. I forgot this, though. I did drink one time in the last, 8 or 9 years, okay?
What was the occasion?
The occasion was I was opening up for Daryl Singletary in the middle of nowhere in upstate New York, and there was nothing else to do than just get hammered. And my wife was like, it's okay to have like a glass of wine. I'm like, no, I'm going to just keep on the straight and narrow. She's like, no, it's cool. And then my guitar player at the time, he's a great guy but a bad influence, he goes, I dare you to drink or try to outdrink me. And I was like, it's on.
That's all it takes is a dare. I dare you to rub my feet right now. I dare you to rub my feet right now.
Actually, I mean, if you're hurting, man, or whatever. I mean, hey, look, I'm comfortable in my own skin. But here's the deal. But dudes, but I'm not that way anymore. But that's what I wrote. You know, we wrote Better I Don't about stuff like that. But the long story short, man, I was getting so hammered. I mean, I was so hammered, and I was like away from Kelly. I was playing horseshoes and cornhole in the back. And if you know Daryl Singletary, first of all, great guy, and had big hits, you know. And one of his songs was, I ain't never had too much fun. And I was sinking these cornholes, and I was like, you never had that much fun, have you, Daryl? Woo! I mean, I was turning into like such a smarty pants. So it's a good thing that I don't drink, man. But other than that, I'm completely sober. And I've never touched a drug, man. I'm just not that guy. I love cigars. I smoke cigars all the time. I had two cigars before we got on this podcast. But I don't smoke cigarettes. I'm allergic to them, actually. Whatever's in a cigarette, I'm allergic to. Not a cigar, though. I can smoke them all day and I'm fine. I guess because you don't inhale them. But I've never touched a drug.
You don't inhale. I don't know anything about cigars. You don't inhale cigars.
Well, I mean, I guess some people do if they're real hardcore.
But I mean, that's not the thing with cigars. I just thought it was a bigger. Okay, what do I know about cigars? Yeah, that's like
cool.
A bigger cigarette.
I think it's just for me. I mean, from what I know and the people I know who've smoked them, it's just kind of a conversation piece, and you just kind of puff on them a little bit and enjoy the aroma, and that's kind of what that's the only thing I do with them.
Do you ever smoke a cigar, Mike?
No,
I haven't either. Yeah, I thought they were just like big. What do I? Know? I don't know anything about anything.
It's cool. It's okay. It's
you know,
good.
The first thing song I ever heard from you was "Better I Don't." Moved to town, and I was like, what is this song, Better I Don't? Believe me, I will. I get looser than a line on a fishing reel. Dare me, don't do. Don't think I won't. What's funny, I heard the song, and so I come to town, and it's a whole to-do because for me, I was the first ever nationally syndicated country morning show. And it was,
yep.
You know, just crazy from the people that were excited, the people that weren't excited, all of these mixed basket of emotions. And I hear this song, and I was like, man, this guy's nuts. Like, I just thought that. I was like, man, this guy's nuts. So I met Chris. Chris was the first ever guest we had on our show, period. Like, we were on the air in just Nashville for a week before we went on the air nationally. And I was like, hey, you sound crazy and good, and that's what I like.
Thank you.
So why don't you come do the show? So Chris showed up and played this song as our first ever guest on a show that no one thought was going to last more than a year. Like, Frank, like really.
Showed down.
So far, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. And Chris came in and just and played this so well. But I do think I look back at that first time, and it was just like, man, it's so good. And then from that time, you know, all the way until now, Deal or No Deal or whatever the occasion, it was just like, let's just call Chris.
Thank you.
Charity event, non-charity event, single, no single. It's like, let's just call Chris. And that's just kind of how it's been for 3.5 years now. Our first freaking guest.
Thank you.
On a show that wasn't going to make it, to a guy that they also told, hey, you're not going to make it. And, hey, we're going to drop you. And hey, we're
plenty of times, dude. I wrote that song with Kelly, my wife.
Really? So it's better I
don't. That's a true story, as you well know.
Let me ask you this. So your wife, also your manager?
Yep.
Okay. How does that work for you?
It's the only way I would do it.
So does that mean 100% of the money just goes into the money?
That's a good question.
Because I have a manager too, and I know she gets 15%. And so you guys are married. I mean, how's that working?
You know what? She has a co-manager that she has that she teamed with. That actually teamed with her. Let me rephrase that. Teamed with her. First of all, let me say, without Kelly, I wouldn't do anything in this business. I had already decided that right before Buy Me a Boat happened. I was very happy and very content. And once it did, I said the only way that I will go forward with this song, and thanks to you for making it a hit that very first moment, the only way I'll do it is if you manage me this go around. And I won't do it any other way.
She wasn't your manager before?
Yeah, absolutely not.
And so this round, now that the new Jansen,
yeah,
the new label, the new the star now, it has been with her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will tell you, and not just because she's my wife, and not just because I'm trying to pat her on the back, but she is the brains behind the operation. Okay, I write the songs and I sing them, yes, but without her just sense of the world, I'd probably be a train wreck.
So you wrote this with her.
Yes.
Fast forward. If you're not going to be an artist anymore, and you're writing songs, because I assume you still had a publishing deal, a decent one, because you're still writing songs. You just decided you were going to be a songwriter? Was that it? You're just going to be in Sandtown and be a songwriter?
I was going to be a songwriter and an independent artist and just be happy and content with that and just tour, because I've always had a fan base, thankfully, because all I've ever known is playing live. You know, it's just what I do. So we've been touring forever, whether it be in my truck. I mean, we used to get in my truck, man, on Craigslist. I'm a Craigslist junkie, right? So I've had a million trucks off Craigslist or cars or whatever, and flip them and sell them just like people do houses. And, man, we get in a Craigslist truck and drive 11 hours on a Friday night to West Virginia. I get up and play for an hour for $500, drive back the same night. I mean, we would just do anything we could to make ends meet and support a family. And I remember just feeling so rich. I mean, I was literally like, I don't know what it was. We were like, God, we are like doing it. We are making it. Like, this is awesome. And we don't have there's no record deal. We don't have to answer anybody. It's an amazing thing. And I mean, just nothing, you know, just nothing. But dude, we got to the point where we're like rolling in a bus and stuff, independent, like just a full blown Prevo tour bus and playing shows. Got a great agent. I have the best agent in the world. Like a guy who didn't care if I had a record deal or not, like just didn't care and just believed in what I did talent wise. And for whatever reason, man, didn't have to give a sales pitch. He didn't have to sell it. He just joined with us and took it in stride, just like we do.
So you're writing Buy Me a Boat. Did you write that for you, or were you just writing it to write at that point?
Brother, I was listening to Hank Jr. records all morning. Came in, Chris DuBois, my co-writer, was like, what you want to write today? And at that point, I had already like I had already prefaced him we had like one co-write before that, and I already prefaced him, like, I don't want to be an artist, blah, blah, blah. He's like, dude, what are you talking about? You don't want to be an artist. Like, you're an artist. That's what you do. That's what you do. We went in and wrote the biggest song of my career.
When you finish this song, were you like, this is a good one? Because you write a lot of songs.
Yes. I will say that. I was like, that is awesome. I actually love that. And I remember telling Kelly about it before we got the demo and stuff. I remember, like, I love this song. Then we got the demo, played for Kelly. Again, the brains of the operation said, that's a huge hit. We're going to put that out. We got to keep your touring going.
So you put it up on iTunes.
Yes.
No label.
Nope. TuneCore.
Yeah, which is just you. I mean, you running your own.
Literally, just running my own little operation. Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about it. You know, I'm just like, whatever. I signed up on TuneCore with my, with my like personal email and everything else. I mean, just whatever. I was like, God, you can go on like 20 different outlets. I'm going on all these, man. I'm going to sell 5 of these things. Man, this is going to be awesome. Between 500.
So, the quick version of this, you email me the song, I play it, it skyrockets. Okay, all that happens. Now, what I want to know is that period between that happening and the song blowing up,
yes,
and the period you signed a record deal.
Yes.
So I play it like 5 times in one morning, and it's obviously a hit because the people listening to the radio made it a hit. They downloaded it like crazy. They love it.
Crazy.
So fast forward past that day and walk me through the next couple of months as you were trying to find a record deal. Were they coming at you from different directions, different labels? Like, what happens then whenever there's a song that's huge from an unsigned artist?
This is a fun part. So that happened. And by the way, thank you.
You know how to say it. That's why I glossed over it. You're welcome. Moving on.
I know that, but I'm just, you know what kind of person I am. And I'm always going to praise you for it, man. You changed your life. You changed my kid's life. It's unbelievable. I really do appreciate it. Whether you can take it or not, I appreciate it. I'm the same way. I can't take compliments, but I mean that. So here's what happened. You played the song. I wasn't even awake yet, as you well know.
I know, we woke you up. Yes.
You got to understand, we just got back from the beach, okay? I had that song, Truck Yeah, McGraw, and we spent every little penny we made off that to buy an investment property, a little itty-bitty beach condo, right? We're down there. We're like redoing it. We're like, oh, my God, we're making it. So awesome, making it. And in the meanwhile, I'm like, oh, crap. I mean, I got TuneCore tomorrow. Kelly's like, get TuneCore tomorrow. And we're on the way back. And, we, you know, we got in it like, when did I email you that? Like 2 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
Okay. So we got in like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I remember being on for Joy Week 3 weeks prior to that. And you said, if you got anything, just send it to me as my buddy. And yes. I was like, man, okay.
And I asked, because people send me music. And when I don't ask, I don't listen to it.
Right.
But I asked you, I was like, dude, whatever you have, send it
and
to
you,
me.
And you know me. Yeah. I'm just, and for people listening out there, I'm just not that kind of guy. Like, I'm just not that guy. I don't want it to come off like, oh, man, maybe he'll play my song. Right. Or maybe,
and it never was
or maybe,
thought to be like
right,
that.
Right. Or maybe not even you, whoever would play my song. Mm-hmm. I'm just not that kind of guy. And you got to understand, the day before you played it, I'm sitting there telling Luke Bryan at a table in Destin, Florida. He's like, man, what you got going on? I said, oh, man, just nothing. Just touring, writing song, you know, blah, blah. We're down here remodeling this thing. He's like, oh, man, that's cool. And then the next morning you played it, and I saw him 3 weeks later. He's like, what the hell, Jansen? I mean, are you kidding? So anyway, you played the song. I wasn't even up yet. I get up. I'm doing the dad thing. I mean, like, Kelly's going to start. We're just doing the normal deal, right? She's like, oh, my God, turn the radio. Go to your truck, turn the radio. My phone's blowing up, like, Bobby Bones playing your song. I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, that's really, what? I mean, I forgot I sent it to you. I mean, that's how nonchalant it was, you know? And so I get in the truck and then we talked on the phone, and in the middle, after I got off the phone with you and Eddie and the crew there, I never forget that when I was talking to Eddie and he was saying it's going up the
right,
iTunes chart. Okay. Right. I was talking to him. I'll never forget. Then when he hung up the phone and I got my first phone call from a record label, and it was Chris Lacey at Warner Brothers. And she was like, oh, my God. What's going on? I'm like, I haven't heard from you, and like, I never hear from you. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, what? I mean, at this point, I'm just whatever, you know? And she goes, do you want a record deal? I mean, do you even want a record deal? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. What's up? Oh, my God. What's going on? I mean, I'm crying. I mean, my dad's crying. I mean, what's going on? I mean, that's exactly how the conversation went. I'm like, I don't even know. Call my wife. She's like, can I call John Esposito at Warner Brothers, who's the president of the label, you know? Can I call him? And can we just get a meeting with you? And I'm like, I'm thinking, boy, how the tables have turned.
Yeah. And you now have leverage. You have a hit. You have leverage.
Oh, my
leverage.
God. Oh, my
you
God.
You have what they want, which is a hit.
Well, it's so that happens. And in the meantime, phone calls are swarming Kelly's phone. Like, how did you get my wife's phone number? I'm talking about like people that we don't even know. People from like out of state, people from out of country. I'm literally, record labels, by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 13 solid real record deal offers, like big ones. The biggest you could get. I liked John Esposito and Chris Lacy, Scott Hendricks, Peter Strickland. I like the team. It was really good.
I was so relieved
when
you signed with them, by the way.
Thank you. Listen to this. So I get in there. The message had to come. There's a very special lady that works at the label, and she would be embarrassed if I even mentioned her, probably because she's like not that kind of person to like to take credit for things. Her name's Lisa Ray. We love her very much. She's my brand manager. She pulled over her car. She was the first person. I didn't know this. She was the first person before Chris Lacy, before anybody knew or even heard it on the radio, who just happened to be listening to your show, had no idea who I was, pulled over her car and goes, "Oh my God," started calling everybody at Warner Brothers, "You have to get a hold of it. Do you know who Chris Jansen is?" Chris Lacy's like, "Of course I do," and turned it on. That's how the whole thing started. So without Lisa Ray, man, like for real, and she's one of our she's our tightest compadre at the label. But without starting with you, bro, like I just can't even imagine where we would be. It's unbelievable. We got offered so many record deals. John Esposito was on vacation, flew in. We had a special meeting. I didn't need to take any more in person meetings than that.
So you signed with Warner Brothers, which, by the way, John Esposito, also known as Espo, is one of my favorite people in town.
Yeah,
like, just a great dude. And also, you know, ran a hip-hop label for a while.
Oh, that's what I love about him.
He ran Def Jam.
Bro, I got to tell you, I never told you this, but you'll get a kick out of this. I'm not going to mention names because it doesn't matter, and I'm still actually, you know, I'm acquainted friends with these people. We've had great successes together, actually, on other projects. However, I wanted to tell you that 2 weeks before you played my song, I was in a label meeting trying to get signed off of Buy Me a Boat and those kind of things, okay? Off my TuneCore project that was about to come out. And they were, I just never forget, a very, very influential executive in town going, "That is not a hit. That will never work. Country music's not going in that direction." And kind of liked my other stuff, but basically just in a very rude way, wasted my time, showed up in sweatpants, like didn't want to be at the meeting kind of thing. And it really got me in a pretty big funk, I'm not going to lie. And so that was, when you played it, it was a big deal. And it was a big deal for my family. And it came at a time where I say this with a lot of pride, and now it's funny. I didn't really want a record deal. I wasn't really looking for one.
Isn't it funny how life works? That's how a lot of life works.
Yeah.
When you're not looking, it's like.
We were not looking for one, man. We were not looking at all for one. Okay. We'd been burnt once before. I had one before that one that we got burnt. That we didn't get burnt. I just, like, the label fell apart. It was just, yeah, I just didn't have a very good, awesome upbringing as far as record labels were concerned. And now I finally feel like we have a home. And it's really cool because they really respect my artistry. And it was more than just Buy Me a Boat. They let me make the records I want to make, and they respect my songwriting, which really matters to me. It really matters to me big time. And, you know, we'd love Warner Brothers. And by the way, there was a guy named Clay Honeycutt who was with iHeart Media at the time. And, you know, before I signed my deal, after you played it, before I signed the deal, he picked me as the first independent artist for the On the Verge program with Buy Me a Boat, which is an unbelievable blessing and something that was huge and very humbling for me. Also, before I signed the deal, CMT, Leslie Fram, came to Kelly. My bosses and all of my cohorts and everybody, we want to come together. We want to make a music video independent for Buy Me a Boat. And they funded the video. It was really an amazing thing. And they did. And then the Warner Brothers deal came in and took effect after the, you know, I had a meeting and everything was just such on the fast track. And then it all just happened. And we're riding this huge wave, and we don't want to get off of it. We really enjoy it, but we're very thankful, and we're very nose to the grindstone. We're still the same people, and we've learned a lot. We've learned what it's like to have the great successes of the music business now, and the upsides and the downsides, and all the in betweens, and we're enjoying it.
So, as you talk about songwriting, we're going to go through and I'll play a song that you wrote on. Give me about a 15-second story about each of the songs.
Sure.
All right, you ready?
Sure, sure.
We did "How I'll Always Be." Why don't we do "Truck Yeah"?
"Truck Yeah," dude. I got in there with my boys Low Cash and another cat named Danny Myrick, Danny's a great guitar player and a great guy on a beatbox kind of thing. He's, I don't know, man. I said, well, F yeah. You know, talking like dudes do in the locker room. And Preston goes, whoa, 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 whoa. What about truck yeah, man? And I was like, yeah, that would never work. And that's how the song came about. And about 20 minutes later, we had a song. And that was my first ever cut recording
Your
on a major artist.
Cut, period.
Yeah.
Ended up being a single and a number one song.
I had a couple things recorded that, like, didn't mean anything. My first cut on a major artist was Tim McGraw, Truck Yeah. We were pushing Georgia, our youngest daughter, around in the stroller. We just had her. That's how God works.
How about this one? I love this life with Low Cash.
Freaking, okay, same crew as Truck Yeah, same exact writers, all three entities. Danny.
What's going to be interesting is how you tell the story, because we heard this story from Preston.
Sure.
But I want to hear how you tell it, because everybody's perspective is always different because you come from different sides.
Yeah, no worries. So, well, it will probably be pretty similar because we're very much on the same page. We all showed up at Danny's house, and I was wired like on 14 Mountain Dews or something. And I go in, and I'm just like, just playing guitar. And Danny's playing guitar. He's a great guitar player, great melody guy. And we all just started rapping off words, okay? And I have to tell you, I have to give a lot of credit to Low Cash on a lot of these lyrics, because they were feeling a Low Cash song, and I was feeling it for them. Now, I will say, when Boys of Summer comes on, yes, Preston, yes, Chris, it's totally my line. I love that line, right? But, man, we just started thinking about happy things, which, by the way, I don't naturally wake up and write these kind of songs. I naturally wake up and write, like, Dean Dillon, George Strait kind of songs, okay, naturally, when I wake up. I had to work at this one, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
How about, and this is the title track from Justin Moore, from his record, Off the Beaten Path.
Number one record.
Yeah, Off the Beaten Path. Off the beaten path. This is my dude here.
Love him.
Like, him and I have a relationship outside of anything work-wise. Like, when I need tickets, this is like solid dude. Yeah,
he is so solid. Story behind the song, 15 seconds. Jeremy Stover, the same guy I wrote How I'll Always Be with. Who also produces Justin, which, by the way, doesn't mean you're going to get a Justin Moore cut. It just happens to be. I sang this demo, actually, and it was a very much, I don't mean to talk in third person here, but it was very much a Jansen song. Like, it was going to be on me as an artist, but I didn't have a record deal at the time, so why did that matter? Justin was cutting, loved the song, recorded the song, ended up being the title track to his number one record, Off the Beaten Path.
What's it like when Hank Jr. cuts one of your songs?
Oh, buddy.
I mean, that's got to be. I mean, you mentioned. You just go play Hank.
Buddy.
And then when he cuts one. Those days are
gone. Thank you, Julian Raymond, who has produced that record and works at Big Machine. What a great guy. If you don't know him, you need to. He's top notch. And thanks, Hank Williams. I'm an old friend of Hank. Hank's an old friend of mine. We go way back. Hank actually gave me my first opportunity to have a major tour. Hank and Lynyrd Skynyrd on the Rowdy Friends Tour 2 years in a row. And Ken Levitan, also his manager, which was an amazing thing. Man, I got two Hank Jr. cuts, and they are my greatest musical achievements as far as songwriting is concerned, period. Because when you grow up listening to Whiskey Bent and Hellbound and Hank Sr. music alike, and then Hank Jr. sends word through the grapevine to Brother Jansen that he wants something that kind of sounds Whiskey Bent and Hellboundish, but not Whiskey Bent and Hellbound, just updated, and you send him Those Days Are Gone, and he cuts it right off the bat.
What was the other one you cut?
God Fearing Man.
Oh yeah. It's gotta be cool to have one of your heroes sing something you wrote,
bro. Honestly, first of all, let me say, my hero is Jesus, and my other hero is, this might surprise you, but my other hero, whom you will meet at some point, is my father-in-law. He's a great man. Great man. We're like two peas in a freaking pod, honestly. Just different ages. Hank Jr., though, is definitely a musical influence, and I would guess you would say country music hero of mine. To have him record those songs, dude, was like, I'm telling you, my greatest musical achievement as a songwriter ever. It will always be, because when you come from where I come, where you come from, where we come from, Born to Boogie is it. All my rowdy friends are coming over tonight. That is the deal. And dude, not one, but two. That was my great, great honor.
You played at the Republican National Convention instead of Truck Yeah. You played Trump Yeah. Whose idea was it to change the word?
Ooh. Honestly, man, I got kind of backed into a corner that night. It was the networks.
So you were going to play Truck Yeah?
I was going to play Truck Yeah. Absolutely. Just Truck Yeah. And they were like, hey, man, how would you feel about doing Trump Yeah? And I'm like, I don't know if I feel so good about that. You know, and it's not because I like or dislike Trump. It's just I don't know if I feel good about doing that.
It just wasn't the song in your mind. It's just, the song is what it is.
Right. And so it is what it is. It's a big hit. Everybody knows it. I've been warming up all day, singing it and that kind of thing. Everybody's like, cool, Truck Yeah, woo, right, party song. It was their idea, but when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And you know what? It kind of worked out because Cruz was getting booed off stage. I start singing it, and Trump walks out and goes,
he thumbs up to you.
He gives me that Trump thumbs, yeah. And I'm like,
with the mouth out.
Like, yeah, it's so good. It was so huge. The song actually is, excuse me. It made me so happy when you did it. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I win the debate. It's over. I won. You lost. That's it.
That's a good impression, dude. Who knew?
Hey, man. Hey, you know what? To answer your question, this is true. I've only ever played music to play music. That's the bottom line. And it was a gig. And
a big one.
It was a big gig. And you know what? No matter if it's for the left side of the road or the right side of the road, a gig's a gig. And at the bottom line is,
they pay you for that?
Of course.
Okay.
Absolutely. No, it was a paid gig. I looked at it as a tour show, which is exactly what it was. It just happened to get a little blown out of proportion because it's a big deal.
Let me hear this. Hold on.
Sure.
This is a... Everybody in the place, let me hear you loud. Say Trump. Yeah, I want to get jacked up. Yeah, let's crank it on up. Yeah. I've never talked to you about this.
Okay.
And I wondered whose idea was it to go Trump. Yeah. Because they didn't make anybody else change their songs.
Right. Well, you know, they were big fans of mine, I guess, and they thought I was a rowdy guy. Like you said, this guy's a little bit wild and crazy. You know what? Looking back, to be frankly honest with you, looking back, probably wouldn't have done it. You know, it's not my song. First of all, it's Tim McGraw's song, and out of respect to Tim, it's a McGraw song. However, it is what it is. You do things along your career path. You just kind of shoot from the hip, and you go with it. And you do what the situation calls for when it calls for it.
Let me ask you, I
didn't want to get stopped. You know, I was in the moment. It just happened.
That commercial that's out now where they're singing. I don't know who's singing it.
I don't either. It's weird.
There's a Truck Yeah commercial for a for is it Dodge or?
It's Ford.
Okay. And they're singing Truck Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not you. It's not Tim.
It's not Locash.
It's not Locash.
No.
But it's Truck Yeah.
Yeah.
They come to you and say, hey, we're going to do a Ford commercial. Can we use your song?
They didn't. I was just as surprised as you were when it came on, and just as surprised as...
You just saw it on TV? You
were just like, I swear to God, I saw it on TV. It's a long story, and I unfortunately can't get into all the details, even though we're close friends.
Are you getting paid?
Well, you know, we'll get residuals off of it because we're songwriter. That you get paid when you're a songwriter. For those who don't know, it is a job. I mean, it's, you know, it's just like any other job, though. You have to work really hard, and hopefully you win. But long story short... That didn't go all down as we all wanted it to collectively. However, again, some things just happen, and some things have to happen sporadically and very quick. And, you know, it just is what it is. The commercial is what it is. I would have preferred McGraw's version be out there. Again, out of respect for my buddy, my friend Tim McGraw, who made a giant hit out of our song and gave us all a job as songwriters.
So before we wrap, let's do a quick high-low.
Sure.
Of your career.
Yes.
High.
Hi.
Not hello. The highest point of your career.
I'm just kidding. The highest point of my career.
You got to pick one moment in your career that's like the highlight for you.
Okay. Hearing Buy Me a Boat on the radio for the first time that morning.
The low.
The low. I honestly... The low, I try not to pay attention too much to the low parts, but I guess if I had to pick one, when your record label just falls apart and you don't know it's going to happen.
I want to take you to another place.
Sure.
In your personal life.
Bring it.
You're high.
My wife.
What part of it? Meeting her? Marrying her?
Everything, man. I really found true love, and that's hard to find. I'm still one of the old time thinkers, I guess, classic thinkers. I still believe in real love, and when you find it, you have to take care of it. And I really love my wife through, I mean, I just love her.
The low
in my personal life. I would say probably any time before I gave my heart to the Lord.
When was that?
April 13th, 2001.
That's the day you became saved?
Day I became a Christian.
Where were you?
Shelbyville, Tennessee, First Baptist Church.
Did you have a plan you were going to raise your hand?
Nope. Actually, I said, I'm absolutely not doing that. I was at a Ken Freeman revival. Ken Freeman's a great motivational speaker and pastor and evangelist. At least he was. I don't know what he's doing now, but never forget it. He was talking, and it just hit me at my heart. And there I went, and I was the only person who went to the altar.
So you walked up as you're walking?
Freaking out.
Hearts racing?
Hearts unbelievably racing. And I, at that point, had never been told about the word, or at least in a way that I felt comfortable with it. Does that make sense? And so went up there by myself, and that was it. Just like that.
Appreciate the talk, man. It's been good.
Dude, this has been my honor.
And I hope everybody listening downloads the crap out of Holden Herr.
Thank you.
And I hope, and I say it not just to your face. I say it when you're not around. I tweet it. I say it to anybody who'll listen. Like, I think pound for pound, you're the best live performer I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Is it unfair to compare you and people with huge pyro? Yeah. If you put two guys up on stage and you just say perform, I don't know anybody that's better than you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm not saying that. And I don't think I've ever told anybody else that on this podcast, because it would be a lie if I did. Yeah. Go check the tape, everybody. But if you get a chance to see Chris out, go see him. Like, if he's playing with an acoustic guitar, he's got a full band, whatever. I do think you are the best. And I think it comes from having to grind for so long. Like, you,
thank you.
You just didn't grow up with those skills put onto you. You worked for those skills because, again, you had to hustle.
Still grinding, baby.
And you're still hustling.
You got to always hustle, man. The minute you quit hustling, you lost.
Chris Jansen, download Holden Herr. Or if you're listening to this in a year, whatever his song is now on the radio, download that one too. I love it. If you're hearing this a year from now, his new single that just came out, I love that one too on it. It's amazing. Like, trust me. Yeah. This thing's last a long time, so.
Yeah.
Whatever song is right now, that's my favorite song on the radio. Whatever it is right now, I love that one. Yeah. All right, Chris, thanks, buddy.
Love you, brother.
Mike,
thank
what episode was this?
26.
Thanks for listening to episode 26 of the Bobbycast. Download the record, buy me a boat, check out all those songs. And thanks for the songs behind the songs.
Thank you for asking.
Behind the artists that you aren't, that you wrote for. The guy, that's interesting.
Who's the guy behind the guy? Who's the big winner tonight? Mikey's the big winner. That's who.
Mike. Follow him on Snapchat. He's our wonderful producer. Anything to ask before we go? You always have a great question or two. Anything?
You said you're back on the Dew. How many are you drinking now?
Mountain Dew.
One and a half today. Not so I'm not really back on it.
At
I'm just,
your worst in Mountain Dew time, what were you drinking?
Oh, easily close to 2 12 packs a day.
I used to drink a 3 liter a day. And I would work out and drink a 3 liter.
100%.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, I feel good. Let me have a 3 liter.
Feels good. Let's get another one.
Crazy. All right, thank you guys. We'll see you next time here on the Bobbycast.